gender-neutral toilets and unisex toilets. We support unisex toilets, but toilets and bathrooms where men and women share the same space are the things that we are trying to get rid of with these new building regulations.
Reverend Campbell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. During the Northern Ireland Assembly campaign, some female candidates were subjected to AI-utilised deepfake and grossly offensive content. What action is being taken by the government to regulate the dissemination of such imagery, where it could affect the otherwise freely expressed choice of voters at the ballot box, especially as we approach a general election in the coming months?
Mr. Speaker, the Online Safety Act did introduce new offences which criminalised the sharing or threatening to share an intimate image without consent, and that includes deepfake intimate images. The government is working to ensure we are ready to respond to the full range of threats to our democratic processes, including through the Defending Democracy Task Force. If deepfakes are discovered by users on social media, they should report them directly to the platform. In the case of elections, they should be reported directly to the Electoral Commission, because it is already an electoral offence to make false statements of fact about the character or conduct of a candidate during an election.
Caroline Donaldson.
Mr. Speaker, having endured an induced coma and six rounds of chemotherapy, 17-year-old Leonie Miller launched her new business at a Wayfinder Woman event last month. Would my honourable friend, my right honourable friend, join me in wishing Leonie every success and outline what support and advice is available so other young women see running their own business as a very real prospect?
I would like to wish Leonie every success, and my right honourable friend is right to raise this issue. In March, we proudly announced the launch of the Invest in Women Task Force. Its mission is to make the UK the best place in the world to be a female founder, and since its launch, the task force members have been working with the private sector to begin raising its fund for female founders, just like my honourable friend's constituent.
Sarah Green.
Both Baroness Cumberledge in the first Do No Harm report and the Patient Safety Commissioner in the Hughes report recommend a redress scheme for women harmed by surgical mesh. What conversations is the Minister having with government colleagues to make this redress scheme a reality for these women who are still suffering?
Well, it's this Conservative government that's commissioned the Patient Safety Commissioner to do a report on what redress would look like. It's really important that we take those recommendations in detail, and actually we are looking at that, and we aim to respond to the Patient Safety Commissioner in the coming weeks.
Mariam Cates.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Some sporting bodies have interpreted the Equality Act in such a way that they believe they cannot lawfully ban males who identify as girls and women for competing in women's sport. Does my right honourable friend agree that this interpretation is not correct, and that it is lawful to exclude all males from female sport to achieve safety and fairness for women and girls?
Chief State.
Mr. Speaker, I do agree. I do agree. There is so much misinformation out there, incorrect guidance that is creating confusion. I recently had a roundtable with the Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport, and she and I both agreed that this is an area which sports bodies in the UK need to tackle more strongly.
Right, that's... I'm not sure the Chief Whip is. Right, let us... We now come to Prime Minister's questions. Jonathan Lord.
Question number one, Mr. Speaker.
Minister.
Mr. Speaker, this morning I had meetings with ministerial colleagues and others. In addition to my duties in this House, I shall have further such meetings later today.
Jonathan Lord.
Residents across the eastern villages of Woking in Byfleet, West Byfleet and Purford have seen a large number of proposed developments over recent years. Of particular concern is an area of beautiful fields near West Hall, where over 1,000 of my constituents have written back to me in recent weeks expressing their deep concerns about the lack of provision of local infrastructure and the potential effects on the local environment. My residents and I will fight on, but does the Prime Minister agree with me that Labour's proposals to concrete over vast swathes of the Greenbelt in Surrey and the South East would be a complete calamity?
Well, Mr. Speaker, my honourable friend is absolutely right. Unlike actually both the Liberal Democrats and the Labour Party, who believe in top-down targets that would decimate the Greenbelt, we believe in local people having a say over their local communities, which is why we are making sure that we make best use of brownfield land and ensuring that we conserve and enhance our precious countryside for generations to come.
We now come to the Leader of the Opposition, Keir Starmer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. On Monday, the Prime Minister treated us to his seventh relaunch in 18 months. He vowed to take on the dangers that threaten the country. So it was good to see the Minister for Common Sense immediately take up that mantle by announcing a vital crackdown on the gravest of threats, colourful lanyards. Meanwhile, in the real world, after 14 years of Tory government, the prison system is in chaos. Does the Prime Minister think that his decision to let prisoners out 70 days early makes our country more secure?
Well, Mr. Speaker, civil service impartiality is an important principle that we're right to support. But perhaps he could ask his Chief of Staff about that. Actually, on Monday, what I did do is outline the serious security threats that our country faces from an axis of authoritarian states. Russia poisoning people on our streets, China targeting our democracy, Iranian proxies firing on British ships, and yet he won't back our plan to increase defence spending. Now, we all know why, especially with the Deputy Leader and indeed the Shadow Foreign Secretary who voted to scrap our nuclear deterrent. It's clear that you simply can't trust Labour with our country's security.
Well, I appreciate he's been busy on the front line of the war against lanyards. But he must have missed this. I was the first to call for 2.5% on defence spending. The last time it happened was under the last Labour government. But it needs a credible plan, not his fantasy economics. But I am disappointed to see that version 7.0 of his time in office doesn't extend as far as answering questions or giving any information on those prisoners he is releasing early. Basic details like how many, where are they, what crimes have they committed? So will he at least guarantee that none of the criminals he is instructing prisoners to release early are considered high risk?
Mr. Speaker, there are strict eligibility criteria in place with exclusions based on public safety, and no one would be put on the scheme if they were deemed a threat to public safety. But he talks about 2.5%, Mr. Speaker. So if he does think it is important, as I think he just actually stood up and acknowledged that it was the right thing to do, we've got a fully funded plan to actually deliver an increase in defence spending. And it's him and his party who have refused to match that commitment.
Just like his £46 billion, fully funded. If anyone was looking for the perfect metaphor for this shambolic government, we saw it on Monday. The Prime Minister woke up deciding his latest rebrand was Mr. Security. But within hours, the Tory party was being investigated for accidentally publishing the personal details of hundreds of people. Mr. Speaker, he must be the only tech bro brother on the continent who can't work a debit card or send an email. But he's not answered my question, so I'll try it again. Are any of the prisoners he is currently letting out early considered to be high risk?
Mr. Speaker, he just showed spectacularly why he's just not fit to lead this country into the future. This country has a proud tradition of leading the world. We led the world when it came to the Industrial Revolution. But if he was around, he would have probably called James Watt the steam bro, Mr. Speaker. And what we're doing is preparing the country for the future. But when he talks about the prison scheme, let me be crystal clear. No one would be put on the scheme if they were deemed a threat to the public. Offenders are subject to the toughest of licensing conditions. And if those conditions are broken, they are are back in prison for considerably longer. But what's his record on this? He voted against tougher sentences for violent criminals. He actually opposed new powers for the police to tackle violent crime, voted against new laws that have arrested 1,000 criminal people smugglers. The message is crystal clear. He can't be trusted to keep this country safe.
I appreciate that all this rebranding is taking all of his time, but he may want to read the recent inspection report into Lewis Prison. On this topic, I've asked him twice about. It documents, page 5, high-risk prisoners being released at short notice without sufficient planning. Page 46, a high-risk prisoner had his release date brought forward, despite a history of stalking, domestic abuse and a restraining order. Shame. Their words, he was a risk to children.
Yeah.
Does the early release of stalkers, domestic abusers and those considered a risk to children sound like the work of someone who is making the country more secure?
Yeah. Well, Mr. Speaker, as I've said, no one should be put on this scheme if they are a threat to the public. And let me be crystal clear, it does not apply. Let me be absolutely explicit, it does not apply to anyone serving a life sentence, anyone convicted of a serious violent offence, anyone convicted of terrorism, anyone convicted of a sex offence. And crucially, in contrast to the system that Labour had put in place, Mr. Speaker, governors in the prison service have an absolute lock so that no one is put on the scheme who shouldn't be. But thankfully, Mr. Speaker, their scheme let out thousands upon thousands of violent offenders onto our streets, and even two terrorists. Thankfully, we've toughened up sentencing against those criminals with new legislation, but he voted against it, Mr. Speaker.
Well, I'm glad to hear that those on life sentences are being released early, and he may not think that releasing domestic abusers is a problem, but Labour has repeatedly called for domestic abusers to be exempt from his scheme to release prisoners early. His government has shamefully ignored those calls. So now we have the evidence that domestic abusers are being released early. The Lewis Report, Prime Minister, will he finally change course and back Labour's calls?
Mr. Speaker, as I've been crystal clear, there is an absolute governor lock on people who are put on the scheme. And in contrast to the last Labour scheme, prisoners were let out with no supervision, no electronic tags. In fact, 80,000 offenders were let out. 16,000 were violent, Mr. Speaker, leading to multiple murders committed. We fixed that system. But when it comes to this question, not only are we building the biggest prison programme in history, we're also deploying rapid deployment cells. And, Mr. Speaker, because on this side of the House, we understand the importance of prison. Unlike one of his frontbenchers who quote, prison doesn't prevent crime. It's always the same with the Labour Party, soft on crime and soft on criminals.
Yeah. He's literally letting criminals out early. And Mr. Speaker, the only answer to the question I asked, whether domestic abusers should be exempt from his early release scheme, from anyone serious about security, is yes. Perhaps the most ludicrous part of the Prime Minister's speech on Monday was when he said he won't accept the idea that any of the problems people are facing are caused by the 14 years of Conservative government. He won't say how many prisoners they've released early. He won't say if they're burglars, abusers or stalkers. He won't say where they are or what support their victims are getting. Yet he thinks he has the right to tell people they can't blame his government for any of it. Doesn't he think that rather than confiscating lanyards like some jumped-up milk monitor, he should stop issuing get-out-of-jail cards free to prisoners considered a risk to children?
Well, Mr. Speaker, another week with no ideas and absolutely no plan for the country. They've had 14 years to think about nothing but the future, but all they can do is talk about the past, Mr. Speaker. But I am surprised, because what he didn't bring up that has happened in the last week since we met is that statistics confirm that we have now had the joint fastest growth rate in the G7 this year, Mr. Speaker. The Bank of England said that the economy had turned a corner. Ian Wye said our growth was impressive. The chief economist of the Independent Office for National Statistics said the economy is going gangbusters, Mr. Speaker. Now, the Shadow Chancellor may want to copy and paste their comments into her next speech. Or does she think they're all gaslighting the British public too?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. While I understand the need to upgrade our broadband infrastructure, it cannot be right that a company called Brisk is proposing to erect telegraph poles in the Squirrels estate in Hayley Green in my constituency. So would the Prime Minister agree with me that residents are 100% opposed to these proposals and they go against the guidance? So would the Prime Minister agree with me that they should abandon these proposals, that they should that we should have a review of permitted development rights in relation to this type of infrastructure, and he should give Ofcom greater power to investigate breaches?
Well, can I thank my honourable friend for rightly championing the views of his constituents on this important topic? Network operators have to follow legal obligations when deploying their networks, and Ofcom can, in fact, investigate reports of failure to follow these obligations. And I know that the Minister for Digital Infrastructure has met the sector and Ofcom recently to raise concerns about reports of poor pole siting, asked operators to share infrastructure, and I will ask her specifically to provide my honourable friend with a more detailed update.
Leader Stephen Flynn.
Yeah. Mr. Speaker, on Monday, the Prime Minister outlined what he considers to be extremist threats to our society. And in doing so, he actively compared North Korea, Iran, and Russia with those people in Scotland who believe in independence. So, can I ask him to rise once to the standards befitting of his office and apologise for those puerile and pathetic remarks?
Mr. Speaker, that's not what I said, but I would say to the honourable gentleman that his party is indeed a threat to the integrity of the United Kingdom. And I hate to remind him, but that's literally their entire purpose, Mr. Speaker. Because when the people of Scotland accepted the referendum in 2014, it was the SNP who didn't. They went on creating a Minister for Independence, focused on constitutional wrangling, ignoring the needs of the people. Education standards falling, taxes rising. So actually, finally, he should do the right thing and end the obsession with independence and put the needs of the Scottish people first.
Well, Mr. Speaker, let's be clear. What the Prime Minister did was not just equate my colleagues and I to despotic and dangerous despots across the world. He proactively compared almost half of the Scottish population with a war criminal like Vladimir Putin. And he did so as their Prime Minister, as the man who represents them on the world stage and the man who on these aisles is tasked with defending their liberties and their democracy. Now, we know that his sorry time in office is rapidly coming to a conclusion. Is this really how he wants to be remembered?
Mr. Speaker, as ever, distracting from the actual record of what the SNP are doing in Scotland. And this obsession with independence means that Scottish schoolchildren are being let down, plummeting down international league tables. The Scottish NHS, the only place in the United Kingdom where funding is actually falling in real terms, and taxes going up for ordinary hard-working families and small businesses. That is what the SNP are doing in Scotland while this UK government is delivering for them.
Will the Prime Minister join me in congratulating Uxbridge College, who have recently entered into a pioneering partnership with the Massachusetts Institute of Technology? This is groundbreaking work for the
further education sector, and it's going to have great benefits for local businesses and local students, for the education sector and for the local economy.
Yeah.
Well, I join my honourable friend in congratulating Uxbridge College and the West London Institute of Technology for their collaboration with MIT. This is equipping students with the skills of the future and that local businesses require, and that's very much the story of this government, Mr. Speaker, the biggest long-term settlement for post-16 education in this country in years, a proud record of creating over 5.5 million apprenticeships since 2010, providing opportunity for all while the party opposite wants to halve the number of apprenticeships and put a brake on people's aspirations.
Roberts.
Okay. My party, Plaid Cymru, has secured a crucial win for our farmers as Labour in Wales are forced to pause the sustainable farming scheme. We've done our bit for farmers. Now it's time the Prime Minister did his. Harmful trade deals and Brexit checks are hitting our world-famous Welsh lamb and beef. Will he, therefore, guarantee to Welsh farmers that he will never again sign a deal that threatens their interests?
Well, perhaps, Mr. Speaker, if the Honourable Lady cared about Welsh farmers, she should stop propping up the Welsh Labour government. And it was actually the work of the Welsh Conservatives that ensured that there was a spotlight on the Labour government's proposals in Wales, which would have led to thousands of job losses, less food security for our country, and destroyed rural incomes. Farmers rightly described it as bleak, damaging and shocking, just like the Labour Party's approach to rural Britain.
Mr. Speaker, Barnet Hospital A&E is expanding. Finchley Memorial Hospital has had its diagnostics hub boosted by new equipment, and there are more appointments in general practice locally than there were before the pandemic, but I still have constituents who are waiting too long for NHS care. So can I urge the Prime Minister to redouble his efforts to grow the NHS workforce and get waiting times down?
Yeah. I'm delighted to hear about the new Community Diagnostic Centre in my honourable friend's local hospital, and we are working tirelessly to reduce the overall NH waiting list, which has come down by around 200,000 since September of last year, and that is an achievement in light of the pressures from industrial action. But she's right, there's more to do, which is why our productivity plan will free up clinicians to spend more time with patients, and to her point, our long-term plan for the NHS will ensure that we train more doctors and more nurses to meet the workforce requirements the NHS has for the future.
Richard Bergen.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. 30,000 Palestinian deaths, not enough to move this Prime Minister to end arms sales to Israel. The killing of British aid workers, not enough to move the Prime Minister to end arms sales. It even seems that, unlike the US, an all-out assault on Rafah, with all the death and destruction that would entail, wouldn't be enough. So just what on earth would be enough to finally move this Prime Minister into the same position as the majority of the British public and end arms sales to Israel?
Mr. Speaker, I just point out to the honourable gentleman that the UK government does not directly sell arms to Israel, unlike the US, and nor does the UK government offer any military lethal aid packages to Israel as the US does. So he should not conflate these issues. As part of the government's robust arms control regime, we do regularly review advice to ensure compliance with international law, and ministers act in accordance with that advice. Our position with regard to export licences, as he knows, is unchanged following the most recent assessment, and it is indeed in line with other partners, including the United States.
As a member of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, I was delighted that the Prime Minister found time yesterday to ignite the light of liberation at the start of its journey to Normandy to commemorate sacrifices made for the liberation of Europe. Will my right honourable friend join me this War Graves week in confirming that standing up to tyrants who bring about war in Europe is as much in our national interest today as it was 80 years ago?
Well, can I thank my honourable friend for his work as a commissioner on the Commonwealth War Graves Commission? And he raises an important point about authoritarian states with different values to ours becoming increasingly assertive. So it is right that we build our security in uncertain times, defending and protecting our country, our values and our interests. That's why we've made the generational decision to increase our defence spending. And it's crystal clear that it's only the Conservative Party that can be trusted with our nation's security.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. On the 2nd of June, the Leavenmouth Railway reopens after years of community campaigning. But just at that point, TSB have announced that they are closing their Leaven Bank branch. Loss of banks hollow out communities, and they're an impediment to small businesses as well. Now, Cash Access UK have said that they're going to roll out 100 by the end of the year banking hubs, and FCA are consulting. But can the Prime Minister accept that the government has been too slow on this, and what else is he going to do to prevent these banking deserts from emerging?
Well, Mr. Speaker, as I've said repeatedly from this dispatch box, it's imperative that banks and building societies recognise the needs of all customers, including those who still need to use in-person cash services. And that's why we legislated to protect access to cash as part of the Financial Services and Markets Act. And as a result, customers can access cash and banking services through a wide range of channels, including post offices, ATMs, telephone and other services, but including community initiatives like banking hubs.
Alberta Costa.
Double child rapist and murderer Colin Pitchfork is yet again having another parole hearing in the next few weeks. As well as the brutal murders, this man exposed himself to over 1,000 girls and women. Now, as MP for South Leicestershire, I distributed a constituency-wide survey asking my constituents about parole board reform. Because the problem, Mr. Speaker, is that the reconsideration mechanism rules allow Mr. Pitchfork to keep asking for a reconsideration of a reconsidered decision, limitless times and cost-free to him. So can I ask the Prime Minister if he will arrange a meeting between myself and the Justice Secretary to discuss necessary changes to the reconsideration mechanism rules? And will he arrange for me to be able to deliver the findings of the survey where thousands of constituents have responded to his number 10 policy team?
Can I commend my honourable friend, the member for South Leicestershire, for his tireless campaigning about this case? And I know that the whole House will join me in recognising the horror of the crimes committed by Colin Pitchfork and sending our condolences to the victims' families. Now, we are reforming the parole system to add a ministerial check on the release of the most dangerous criminals and changing the law so that society's most depraved killers, life means life. But I will, of course, arrange for the findings of my honourable friend's survey to be properly considered and will ensure that he meets with the Justice Secretary to discuss his proposals further.
Shozan Alan Khan.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. In Gaza, Israel has attacked hospitals, it's attacked refugee camps, and it has killed aid workers. Israel has blocked vital aid, turned off water supplies, and denied access to food. Israel has killed thousands upon thousands of innocent civilians as the world watches, trampling all over international humanitarian law. No other country would be allowed to act with such impunity. So, can the Prime Minister tell me why he allows Israel to get away with it unchallenged, and why he continues to act as a bystander to such horror?
Well, Mr. Speaker, well, we do support, and I do support Israel's right to defend itself and remove the threat that Hamas, the terrorist organisation, poses to its people. But I am also deeply concerned about the growing humanitarian crisis in Gaza, and have consistently made that point at this dispatch box and to Prime Minister Netanyahu. We must see further action to ensure more aid gets to people who desperately need it. The Rafah and the Kerem Shalom crossing must be open to allow more aid in. We're doing everything we can, trebling our investment, trying to get aid in by land, air and sea, and currently working with allies to build a temporary pier. But she can rest assured that we, on this side of the House, will continue to do everything we can to get support to the people in Gaza who need it.
Neil Crosbie.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Last week, along with apprentices from the nuclear fuel company Urenco, I visited Coleg Menai in Llangefni. The students were excited, but they need certainty about the future of Wylfa before they commit to a career in nuclear. Can the Prime Minister confirm when Great British Nuclear will decide if Wylfa will be a gigawatt or an SMR site, when my students can expect to see spades in the ground, and when can his brilliant nuclear minister visit Wylfa again to announce some good news?
My honourable friend is a tireless campaigner for the Wylfa nuclear site in her constituency. Now, she knows that the spring budget, the Chancellor announced that Great British Nuclear has reached an agreement to purchase the site at Wylfa, and these and one other site will be vital to achieving our aim of more energy security from nuclear power. Decisions haven't yet been made on the final site to be used, but as ever, she makes a very strong and compelling case for her area. And as soon as a decision has been made, I know that the Energy Secretary is keen to update her at the earliest opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In March, the Parliamentary and Health Service Ombudsman's report into 1950s women's state pension injustice made clear to the government that the Department for Work and Pensions was guilty of maladministration, that these women suffered significant injustice, that they were owed compensation, and that Parliament must urgently identify a mechanism for redress. Nearly 279,000 of women have already died waiting for justice. So when will the Prime Minister finally place before this House a mechanism for appropriate redress?
Well, Mr. Speaker, as I said to the House last week, I understand the strong feelings across the Chamber about these matters and the desire for urgency in addressing them. And following the Ombudsman's multi-year investigation, it is imperative that we take the time to thoroughly review the findings, and I'm not entirely sure I agree with her characterisation of all of them so far. But broadly, we are committed to making sure that pensioners have the dignity and security they deserve, including through the triple lock, which is increasing pensions by £900 this year. But I welcome tomorrow's debate on the Ombudsman's report, and we will, of course, take all views into account as we identify and implement next steps.
Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I know that my right honourable friend, the Prime Minister, takes a personal interest in community pharmacy. Community pharmacists play an essential role in reducing pressure on urgent care services by helping people prevent ill health and managing long-term conditions. Pharmacy First is a good example of government commitment to community pharmacy. However, community pharmacy are under extreme financial pressure, and some are closing, including in St Ives. This year, 177 pharmacies have closed, compared to 116 last year. Will my right honourable friend do everything he can to ensure funds are directed towards community pharmacy so that our pharmacy friends can help government to deliver NHS services where and when they are most needed?
Minister.
As my honourable friend knows, I do care deeply about the future of our community pharmacies. There are over 10.5 community pharmacies across the country working incredibly hard to serve their patients, and I'm pleased that around 80% of people live within a 20-minute walk of a pharmacy, and that's why we're backing them with Pharmacy First, with £645 million of extra funding, whereby people can now go and see their pharmacist rather than their GP to get treatments for the 7 most common ailments, like ear infections and the like. And this will ensure that not only can they get treatments closer to home, Mr. Speaker, but it will help deliver our plan to cut waiting lists and get people the care they need more quickly.
Linda.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. 3 North Tyneside schools have been identified with a structural problem, not RAC, with hundreds of pupils now taught off-site. Costs of putting these schools right significantly outweigh the £3.5 million SCA fund for all of North Tyneside. Will the Prime Minister ensure the Department of Education applies the policy that, if it's alerted to significant issues with a building that cannot be managed with local resources, it will provide additional support on a case-by-case basis?
Yeah. Well, Mr. Speaker, I thank the Honourable Lady for raising the case. As she knows, the Department for Education has provided extensive support and funding to all those schools that had RAC, which in the end was less than 1%, I think, of all schools that could have been affected. And more generally, given the very significant amounts we're investing in school rebuilding and maintenance, I'm sure that the Education Secretary would have heard her concerns and will write to her in due course.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The clear message from yesterday's Farm to Fork Summit is that food security
matters. So as we await today's written statement on ground-mounted solar, can my right honourable friend assure me that the thousands of acres of agricultural land proposed for solar installation in my constituency, from a 2,100-acre installation in the Claydons called Rosefield to smaller but equally destructive ones such as near the village of Kimblewick, now have less chance of getting approved?
Yeah.
Honourable friend is absolutely right to raise this, and particularly at a time of increasing geopolitical risk, we must protect this nation's food security and therefore our most valuable agricultural land. Now, we can achieve our solar deployment targets and do that on brownfield sites, rooftops and away from our best farmland. I know he'll look forward to the Energy Secretary's statement later today, which will ensure that we do avoid using our best agricultural land, because like him, I agree that we should be backing British farmers to produce more food. That's good for our country, good for our economy and good for our food security.
Helen Morgan.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. I've seen for myself the mouldy and damp accommodation that our military families are sometimes forced to live in. So I was disappointed this week to find out that the officer in charge of accommodation wrote to families this month to say that requests for non-urgent repairs are not currently affordable. The Prime Minister has spent this week claiming that defence is a priority. So when is he going to prioritise a safe, warm and decent home for the servicemen and women who put their lives on the line for us?
Well, Mr. Speaker, we're committed to ensuring that our armed forces personnel and their families have safe and well-maintained accommodation. At this point, 96% of service family accommodation meets or exceeds the government's decent home standards. And last year, we put aside an extra £400 million investment to improve things. And when issues are reported, the Ministry of Defence has set up a dedicated hotline to ensure that those complaints are investigated by a professional surveyor. And I know that there have been several improvements made specifically to the accommodation in her area. But again, we are able to continue backing our armed forces personnel and for the job that they do for us, because we are the only party in this place committed to increasing our defence spending.
Mr. Speaker, this week the all-party parliamentary group on birth trauma published our first report called Listen to Mums, Ending the Postcode Lottery on Perinatal Health. This was the first national inquiry by cross-party politicians on this issue, and we received more than 1,300 testimonials from the public. So can I thank the Health Secretary first for attending our report launch on Monday, and I'm delighted she's agreed to our headline recommendation for a national comprehensive maternity strategy to be published by NHS England. So can I ask the Prime Minister to fully back our report and implement all of our recommendations to ensure that all mothers in this country get the aftercare that they deserve?
Well, can I thank the Honourable Member for Stafford for her incredible campaigning on this issue. When we met and discussed, she presented me personally with a copy of this important report, and I'm hugely grateful to her and the APPG on birth trauma for carefully considering the report, and indeed all those brave women who have come forward to share their stories. I'm delighted that the Secretary of State and the NHS CEO both support the overarching recommendation for a comprehensive national strategy to improve maternity services. We will update the House on next steps in due course, but we are fully committed to improving the quality and consistency of care for women throughout pregnancy, birth and the critical months that follow.
Final question, in other words.
Mr. Speaker, when adult rape cases are taking 2 years on average to complete, it's no wonder that 62% of all rape survivors now drop out of the process. When just 2.5% of rapes recorded last year have resulted in a charge, and fewer still will end in conviction, it's no wonder that the Victims Commissioner, Rape Crisis and others have argued that rape has been effectively decriminalised in this country. Is the Prime Minister not ashamed that because of his government's failings, victims and survivors are being put through a living hell in our criminal justice system?
Well, Mr. Speaker, while it's right that the Honourable Lady raises this incredibly important topic, I completely disagree with her characterisation of how this government has treated it. It's actually this government previously that introduced the Rape Review Action Plan, which is now showing significant improvements to how we treat rape end to end through the criminal justice system. Violence against women and girls is now a strategic policing requirement for the first ever time. We've rolled out Operation Sorteria so that police forces have the expertise that they need. We've actually quadrupled funding for victim support with more independent domestic sexual violence offender advisers. There's a new 24/7 support for victims. We've ended the digital strip search, provided pre-trial cross-examination, all of which, by the way, has meant an improvement in the process. And we have seen an increase in the average sentence to rape by a third since Labour were last in office. And by the way, Mr. Speaker, we did that using a power that her party voted against.
That completes Prime Minister's questions.